Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Doesn't happen very often, but our first guest was our guest is somebody who was with us yesterday. So, and he's our first guest in our fifth year. How about that distinction, Andy?
I really don't know what to say, Mac. I'm overwhelmed.
Well, I think the appropriate response is nobody can believe you made it to the fifth year. What the hell?
That's absolutely correct. You took the words out of my mouth.
But
in all seriousness, congratulations, Mac. Well, I echo the words of all your listeners, I'm sure.
Well, you know what? I sent you an email, and I read it a little bit ago, and from a retired first sergeant who listened to the interview with you yesterday, talking about the suicide of your sister here recently, and that it will help people, and I mean, and that was really my hope when I had this idea, was that, we didn't really talk about it. Guys who had problems, they kind of slunk off to mental health, wherever the hell that was. And we didn't really talk about it. I mean, we got told, coming and going to the places that we fought, that these services were available. And we heard stories about guys having to go. But it wasn't really important to the rest of us. And then, we saw the suicide numbers go up and all the other, the divorce numbers go up, the alcohol-related incidents and alcohol abuse numbers go up. And then those numbers kept going up. And so I mean, my thought was that, well, if we could talk about it, as it was kind of a normal part of our job, because it is, then maybe we could have an impact on it. And I look back 4 years later and know that, we've done that, and we're actually just started, or we've started to have an impact, and excited about the next 4 years. But it's people like you, Andy, that come on and aren't afraid to talk about their life. They're not afraid to talk about the truth of their life. I always tell my kids, man, life's not for pussies, man. Life is, you're going to fight for every bit of happiness that you get on this planet, and then you're going to fight to keep it. And you got to be up for it. But we don't really talk about it like that. And so it's people like you that have come on, that have told, the story of the death of your daughter, the story of death now of your sister. And, one of the things that you said that I'll never forget is, after the death of your daughter, Kayla, you said, I don't really have a memory of the month leading up to the deployment or something like that. Yay?
Yeah, you've got a really good memory. It's paradoxical talking about loss of memory. Well, yeah, it was like a total blackout period. It's extraordinary. Total blackout. I pieced together what happened in that month from memories of those around me. And, it wasn't a month where I could have simply hunkered down, which is perhaps a good thing. I had to, prepare for deployment and lead a siege assault through our final pre-deployment exercise. And strangely enough, I functioned apparently well. I just have no recollection of that period, which I have also heard is not an unusual response to grief.
It's one of the best things that's ever happened to me in my life, doing this, the people I've met, and, and I sent Andy, when I forward him, that email that I received, I told him that, you know, as a student, you were pretty marginal. But in the rest of your life, you become, you know, a baller. And but again, when those stories impact other people, that to me is why we become leaders. And but it's a little bit different sharing it in public. And you're not afraid to do it. And I honestly, I appreciate it because I know that it's hard. You know, what are people going to say and yada, yada, yada. So,
well, I appreciate that, Mac, but I also appreciate the fact that you've called me up into the marginal spectrum. I think that's a rosy tinted lens because at the time your view was definitely that I was way below marginal. Thank you for that.
I was being kind. No, we were all, you were marginal because you had an interesting accent. Right? It's like, so you're actually, without the accent, you're like a bottom feeder. But with the accent, it's like, whoa, who is this guy? He sounds smart with that English accent. So that's a part of the deception plan. Well done.
That's been the story of my career. You know, always have a fresh haircut, the English accent, and speak authoritatively and state the obvious.
There you go.
But authoritatively. And that'll get your head in the Marine Corps.
Let me tell you, stating the obvious and never going beyond that, right?
No. Just but very ponderously and with authority.
Right.
In a low voice.
Right.
And that is, your chin.
Let me tell you, that's critical because, right, you can become the commandant of the Marine Corps if you're a high-performing conformist. And conformists don't go beyond the obvious in public.
Yep, so, that's very true. Hey, there's two other qualities that I lack that are absolute dead certs for getting your head in the Marine Corps. One is to be big. You know, I mean, if you're like well over 6 foot and big, that's a huge asset as an officer. That'll get you listened to. And the other thing is being good looking. Now, if you combine those two and all those other traits that I just mentioned, you're a shoo-in as a general officer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can, unless you really screw up, you got to work hard to screw up them.
The Marine Corps loves big dudes. Just for the record, if you're a big dude and like you can say, give me the upper receiver, the 50 cal, right? I'll hump that bitch. If you're not a big dude, man, that's like okay, man, we're going to see what you're made of. There's a 50-50 chance you're going down hard with that.
You're playing back up the rest of your career.
With that silly act of bravado. The Secretary of Defense came out today. I want to get your thoughts on this because you and I have talked about, you know, issues involving, you know, ethical leadership, you know, confronting, you know, when do you confront seniors? I think one of the reasons Mark Esper is the Secretary of Defense is he's a B-team guy. He's not Jim Mattis.
Yeah.
And so I think President Trump had enough of Jim Mattis and having to deal with a big personality and a big person in that issue. And so it's easier to have a B-team guy who's going to go do what he's supposed to do because he's never supposed to be in this position to begin with, and that is Mark Esper, right? And so today, this morning, he comes out and says, I'm not in favor of using federal active-duty troops to use in support of the Insurrection Act to intervene in these protests. And then he also said he had no intention of participating in the president's photo op. He thought they were going over there to speak to reservists that were serving in the area. And so I don't know. Are we now towing Mark Esper out to Cat 1 and preparing him to be launched out of the administration? Your thoughts on all that, Andy?
Yeah, I would think so. You know, it's very interesting. The who's the guy who resigned yesterday, James Miller, and his letter to Esper, he makes a comment in there that resonates with me and I think will resonate with you. And it's something to the words to the effect that all of us who take an oath of office have to decide what line we will not be willing to cross. and beyond which we will resign. And so basically, you know, Miller says that that whole debacle in front of St. John's Cathedral, you know, Lafayette Square, was that line for me. And he says, you know, I'm not sure if that wasn't a line for you. I don't know if you have one, basically. And he says that a little more tactfully than what I have. But it's a, you know, that point is absolutely, again, it resonates with us because what we've discussed here before, where you there has to be a line somewhere. Why was that particular image so? Why did it carry such weight? You know, the image of the president kind of posturing in front of clouds of tear gas, peaceful protesters being cleared from that area forcibly in order to enable kind of this staged presentation, this photo play. And the reason why it's important is, A, you know, arguably both Esper and Milley violated their oath to the Constitution by supporting that. And so because those protesters were not causing problems, they were fulfilling the rights under the Constitution and yet were cleared out of the way just for this photo op. And I accept, you know, I don't think that Esper or Milley are lying, but there's some points here that are a little concerning because they indicate a level of naivete among two of the most powerful leaders within DOD. One is, you know, the fact that they allowed themselves to not realize, not be aware of their surroundings and kind of just troll along. And the second point is perhaps, you know, it may seem insignificant, but General Milley donning camouflage utilities, which of course he doesn't customarily wear, it sends, whether he realizes it or not, kind of an implicit message about, you know, that about bringing, whether the decision's made or not, but it sends that message that, hey, this is the new battleground. And it kind of echoes what Esper had said previously, describing American cities as battle spaces, you know, for a comment for which he has been attacked, and I'm sure that he regrets. But all of this kind of feeds.
Yeah,
into...
he said that he this morning he said that he regrets using that language.
Yeah, but you know, you kind of when that's one of the problems with being Secretary of Defense is that there are no, you can't afford to make offhand comments.
Well,
you have to be circumspect in what you say.
But Andy, I mean. Do you not think that on that call with governors, that everything that we say is going to go straight to the media? We know that. I mean, the governor of Michigan probably got reporters sitting in there listening to it as she's doing it. You know, so I mean, it's and everything Donald Trump does is turbocharged with political electricity. So to me, it's a little bit astounding that he would make such remarks, and even the president's use of the word dominate, you know, you're trying to diffuse this thing, because when I read you say dominate and I'm on the other side, my attitude is fuck you, dominate this, right?
Yeah.
And it's so tone deaf to me. It's just like you're just sitting there scratching your head saying, good God, man, what the fuck?
Amidst all this turmoil, there are two important points that military leadership appears to have lost sight of, although perhaps based on Esper's comments today, he's bringing them back into focus. Okay, number one is that things, you know, despite the media coverage, things have not devolved to a point where we really need to bring in the U.S. military under the Insurrection Act. And that is, you know, obviously that's a judgment call, but
you're absolutely right.
Let's look at this. I mean, when you read through the Insurrection Act, I mean, this is when it is intended to bring an active duty military when circumstances have gone beyond what civil authorities, to include the National Guard, can handle. And we have to ask ourselves whether we have reached that point. We are not, as Admiral Mullen pointed out in an article yesterday, right, at a point where we're we're facing a mass armed insurrection or civil war, which is really what was envisioned by the Insurrection Act. We're nowhere near that. So the cost, and you and I are very well aware of this, that there is an intangible cost. Even if everything goes well, even if miscalculations are not made, there is an intangible cost to seeing you at the U.S. military, active duty military on America's streets, confronting America's citizenry. And that intangible cost comes in terms of the high perception and the trust that the American public has in its military. And that may seem like airy fairy stuff, but for those of us who fought for this country, that level of trust sometimes has given what we're doing more meaning than anything else. So to risk that when it doesn't need to be risked it just doesn't make sense. Okay, that's number one. Number two, and I know a lot of your listeners will understand this. It sounds very authoritative and reassuring to say we're going to send in the 82nd Airborne or 101st Airborne or even the Marines into the streets of D.C. But the type of training required for to handle civil disorder, as you know, it's pretty intensive, and it is, like all military skills, perishable. When was the last time, when you are in active duty, when was the last time that you received training in crowd control, for instance?
We did it in 29 Palms in 1993, as we got notified that I was a LAR company commander, that for the second trial of the police officers that was taking place in Riverside, that we were on tap to support the guard if that eventuality arose. And so we went out and we did it. And, you know, and I will say this, I mean, it's not skills that the military that we have, because ultimately, you know, we're a close with and destroy organization. And the soft skills of dealing with people and escalation of force and things like that, those are gray area skills that are hard. And, you know, we learned them in combat, but to learn them on the streets of the United States with guys who've never fought, and that's jumping across the Grand Canyon. And I will say this, to me, I saw the mayor of Los Angeles. No, I saw the sheriff of Los Angeles last night. And he got asked about the use of the guard. He said, well, really, the guard is a force multiplier for us. And he said, the guard comes in and relieves us of responsibilities of a lot of fixed site security for City Hall, for, you know, the police departments, for police precincts and things like that, which frees up police officers to then go to the point of conflict. And to me, that's the appropriate use of the guard. You know, yeah. And so envision a situation like the riots in LA, where now the police force, you know, even with the guard, you know, being a force multiplier, it's still out of control. Now you have a situation that the Insurrection Act would apply to, right? But again, you know, that's very, very rare in the nation's history, and something that was, you know, engulfed an entire city. But I do think, Andy, I'll let you finish your thought, and I want you to address this. What we've seen this last week was a scripted event by a couple of groups operating probably congruently but not coordinated, and that is Antifa-like organizations, and probably including Antifa too, but I don't know that, who use protest to create anarchy, then
create reaction and overreaction.
Right. They channel the energy of the protest into looting, and it's not hard to do. Okay. Yeah. And then two, underneath that is crime organizations, gangs, and organized crime that now use that to go loot. And I mean, I've seen the caravans that have been put together by gangs and different crime organizations that are between 10 and 15 vehicles, right? that, you know, and they're just armed with hammers and cameras because they're videotaping the whole thing because they want to watch it again when they're to get done. And they're going, they were on Rodeo Drive right there in Westwood and Brentwood, you know, and they're using that as part of their criminal enterprise. So to me, I believe to counter that in the future, the National Guard ought to be part of the playbook earlier than later so that this thing doesn't get out of control, that the Guard comes in and they relieve the police and the sheriffs of fixed site security, which allows the police and the sheriffs to overwhelmingly respond so that we don't have this mayhem in our cities. So let me shut up and you can comment on all of that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, it's a, no one, you know, the problem with this whole discussion over the last, you know, over the last week, there's a number of problems. You know, it's become highly charged and emotional on all counts, and people jump from, you know, the death of George Floyd to the looting and the rioting, and those are essentially two disconnected issues. You know, you, I've listened to the great conversations you've had on this radio station in the last week or so with Will Constantini and others talking about the problems of culture within police departments, and that is a fascinating topic, and we can probably, you know, hit on that before ending the program. And but that's separate from the right to protest, which in itself is separate from the issue that we're seeing on the streets now with criminal behavior. You know, it's so sadly, people as usual have become quite bipartisan in their outlook and said, yeah, what happened is wrong, but, you know, we need to go after the looters. That's two. Yeah, absolutely. These are two, you know, disconnected issues. To your point, yes, absolutely. There's an element of, I don't know for sure, but, it, you know, just from reading, I'm no expert. It does seem there's an element of organization and some kind of coherence behind the behavior of both looters and the you know, the rioters, but you know, the Antifa is not the Islamic State. They don't have an army of tens of thousands of trained fighters, heavily armed. They don't have a networked command and control system, you know, that extends through every state, and so the terminology and the optics that we've been using of this as a military campaign are just, you know, they're counterproductive.
Talk to me about Esper. I want to go back to Esper. Pretty big act of moral courage on his part relative to the president, because I'm sure he's under no illusion that he's going to get the Fauci treatment, right? I saw Tony Fauci get interviewed, and he said he rarely has, you know, contact with the president anymore. And it seems that, you know, once you don't toe the president's line, once you don't corroborate his statements, right, you go to the outer, you know, sanctum of the meeting. And I can't imagine how difficult it is to try to do your job and to have to tiptoe around, you know, the president's statements when he's, you know, when he's being the flamethrower in chief and bloviating about, I'm going to send it in federal troops. And you're just going, oh, shit, man, I'm going to stay in the basement here for a week or so I don't have to get asked about that in public. And so Esper heretofore, you know, he's been Trump's guy, and today he's not, you know, in a very public way at a very delicate time. So it'll be interesting to see what the future holds for Mark Esper, because in the past performance is any indication of future returns, he's not going to be with us for very long.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it, that this president seems to have a tendency of pushing people to that point where they have to weigh their personal ambition against their principles. And some people, as we found, will go a surprisingly long way in terms of their personal ambition and allow that to trump their, no pun intended, to trump their principles and keep moving that line backwards, you know, the line beyond which they've decided that they will not cross on, you know, on question of principle. And, you know, I don't mean to take cheap shots at Mark Esper, but I was concerned that he didn't have a clearly defined line. And I've written about this, you know, about the increasing politicization of the military under his watch and how he just seems to allow it to happen and not make a stand and not say anything. But I think that debacle, I don't know, but I think that debacle in Lafayette Square was perhaps, you know, his Rubicon. I think that was perhaps the point at which he suddenly thought, oh God, you know, that when I did take an oath of office and I do believe in this country and I do believe in the institution that I swore to protect. And, you know, now's the time maybe to subjugate my personal ambitions to those. I can't get inside his mind, but I would assume that. And I think the flood of articles that have come out in the last 24 hours from, you know, former senior officers, to include Admiral Mullen, probably helped to make that decision. I think it's belated, you know. I think it's frankly, but it's better now than never. Be interesting to see what happens. Is he going to be marginalized? Is he going to be fired? If I was him, I would preempt the president and just resign. You know, why wait for the axe to fall and at least then. In years to come, he will have something to hold on to in posterity as a man of principle, rather than just allow himself to be beaten down and eventually fired.
I agree with that. Let me read you an email. Mac, you mentioned it earlier, but I saw the mayor of New York refer to the New York National Guard as a foreign military. Did Andy see that? If so, does he have any thoughts on it? Did you see that?
No, I didn't. As a foreign military.
whenever we bring foreign military units, right, into the city or something like that, it only escalates the violence.
Yeah, I think, you know, what I'm guessing he meant is an organization outside NYPD, you know.
But
you know what? No, and seriously, that makes the point that I'm making, that the once we deploy U.S. active duty military to the streets, there better be a really good reason, because there is automatically going to be, in the perception of the American public, even the most hawkish proponents of using force against protesters at some point are going to see our own military as an occupying force in our cities, you know, especially if they're running checkpoints and just the optics of seeing military police on, you know, the steps of the Capitol or you know, around the White House is one that I think probably many of us in uniform find a little distasteful. And again, it gets back to that intangible perception that the American public has of the military. The military, and you know, I may be misstating this, but it's definitely in the top three most trusted professions. I want to say it is.
It's number one.
Most trusted, yeah. Profession.
That should mean
a tremendous amount to all of us, because as we find ourselves deploying as part of an all-volunteer force, or those of us who have deployed to fight wars for which sometimes there seems to be no real strategy or coherent cause, that's the one thing that we can justify to ourselves and our subordinates. The American public has trust in you and believes in you. You do this mission for each other and you do it for them. So to put our guys into a position where they, guys and girls, run the risk of violating that trust or being perceived to violate that trust or being on the other side is not a decision that should be made lightly. And again, I'm not saying it should never happen, but it should happen only in a last resort. And we've already, you know, discussed the possible consequences. I've talked about the intangible costs, right? What about the very real dangers of miscalculation resulting in needless deaths of American citizens, you know, the Kent State type situation, right, which is not far-fetched. Our guy, you know, the men and women of our armed forces, as you know, are very highly disciplined, but they are not trained, as we pointed out, for this type of situation. You put them in a highly volatile situation, you are not, you know, you're not fulfilling your obligation to them. I'm talking from the viewpoint of military leadership, and you're certainly not fulfilling the obligation that you have to protect and defend the Constitution by allowing for that kind of confrontation to allow between America's soldiers and its citizenry.
That's why I thought the comments made by the LA sheriff were, you know, it made me go, that guy's got a clue, right? In terms of the guard being a force multiplier that allows the police then to surge more forces where they need to. And really what I've watched the news here exhaustively, the local news here for the last few nights, kind of just watching how the Los Angeles Police Department, the Orange County Sheriff's Department have responded to this. And it's been pretty interesting as they've kind of refined their tactics, which is the protesters aren't doing anything wrong, right? I mean, they're harmless. So yeah, really what you're doing is you're protecting them to make sure that nothing crazy happens there. And then what you're looking for with your aviation units and, you know, alarms and 911 calls are you're looking for the looters. And so that's what they've refined this to. And that's why, you know, the guard, in my opinion, does have a role, and the active duty does not have a role in all this. And I think that Los Angeles has evolved that. And so when you see the mayor of New York City saying, yeah, it'll only further escalate the situation. Well, I guess if you use it as Kent State uses it, but if you use it, you know, but again, the video of Manhattan being sacked, which is, I think, happened for the first time since the War of 1812. I mean, it was amazing. It looked like thousands of people running around. You know, I think I saw that it was like somebody like Cartier or somebody had like $2.4 million of watches stolen from their business in like smash and grab. And it was as people marauded through Manhattan. And then you have the mayor saying, oh, it'll just make things worse. Like, wow. So it's been amazing. It's been amazing to watch. And really what's been amazing to watch is the level of organization and the quick way that these organized gangs or criminal enterprises have seized on the police response to the protest, knowing that they can't respond to these smash and grab things, and then have executed them throughout the nation in very, very, you know, in very, it's almost like it's, you would think it would be centrally coordinated in this organ, but it's not. It's just, you know, how quick criminals, you know, can see what's going on and seize and apply that in their circumstances. So it's been
greed is a very powerful motivator. Oh, it's a very powerful automatic organizer. It's we've certainly seen that evidence of that. And it's, you know, for those who are those of us, I think, you know, I would hope all Americans are concerned about what happened to George Floyd. It's sad that issue is being obscured by, you know, the acts such as that.
Well, and I want to get your thoughts on this. I want to give you, because this is not an easy discussion to have. And I'll give you a little background. 9 unarmed black men were killed by police in the United States in 2019. Now that's a shocking number for most people, because most people think it's much higher. I asked my 16-year-old daughter, Colleen, and she told me, she said, I said, how many? She said 200. I asked my 26-year-old daughter, and she said 50. And they were both stunned. My 26-year-old daughter didn't believe me, right? So I showed her the data from the Washington Post website. 82 police officers were killed in the line of duty. 54, you know, black people in this country represent 13% of the population, about. And yet they represent 54% of the homicide charges in the country. They represent 53% of the armed robbery charges in the country. They represented, they represent like 48% of the, you know, weapons charges, concealed weapons, weapons violations and whatnot in the country. So what the police will tell you in this discussion is that we're crossing paths in a violent way with them, right? And the untold story, though, is the numbers of unarmed black people in this country killed since the Washington Post started that database after the Ferguson event has declined by 56% over 5 years. And yeah. then the percentage of blacks in that annual number has declined from 40% to 22%. So that's, I would tell you.
So that, the trends, your point is that the trends are in the right direction.
The trends overwhelmingly in the right direction. 56% yeah. down over 5 years and a 50% decline, right, from 40% to 22%. In the relative number in that as well. So not only making, you know, strides in the overall number, but the relative percentage. But so now, and Andy, the reason I think that's so important is that if we're going to force those numbers even further down, you've got to talk about the whole equation. But I'll ask you this. If you and I stood out there, you with the camera and me with the microphone, and started asking people in this in these protests that question, how many do you believe, and then told them the truth, how long do you think we would be out there before we got our ass beat?
Yeah.
And my right. my concern in all of this is the truth isn't part of the discussion, and which to me scares the shit out of me.
No, I understand your point, Mac, and it kind of it kind of paradoxically plays into something that Spike Lee said the other day, that, you know, racism, this racism isn't new, filming it is, you know, so that you, right. you know, to your point that things might actually be getting better, but the cases that occur receive greater publicity so that it gives.
Well, there's even a statistic about that, that, you know, in 2018, I want to say 16% of the unarmed killings by police were videotaped. In 2019, it was 20%. So if it's 20%, you're going to see two of those killings on videotape, you know, last year. And you're probably going to see a similar number, you know, on videotape this year. And the power of videotape, I mean, we saw it relative to the
it's enormous.
Relative to the Roosevelt relief.
Yeah.
If there wasn't that video of those 150 sailors, 120 sailors on a crew of 4,800 chanting Captain Crozier as he left the ship, without that video, does that issue get the same level of coverage?
Never would have.
Right.
And, you know, Mowgli probably wouldn't have flown out there and got himself relieved,
right.
you know, and the, but this, but that, you know, the, it, I mean, that, that is not a, that in itself isn't a new factor. I mean, think back to the LA riots, you know, what sparked that? And it was the early days. Obviously it wasn't a camera phone back then, but it's, you know, someone happened to film the Rodney King beating, right? And that's what sparked the whole thing. Go ahead.
Matt. No, but again, so when you try to have a grown-up conversation so you can begin to address the issues relative to the police, relative to civilian, this behavior of civilians when they come in contact with law enforcement officers, it's not, right? The popular narrative is not, to me, is not the whole issue, right? You've got to get your hands around the whole issue.
Yeah. Right?
And again, you know, 9 black people killed that were unarmed. 82 police officers killed last year.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is actually, you know, I hate to sound callous, but not a high number. The police, I mean, it's 80 too many before your viewers call in angry at me. My point is that the police, being a cop, is not even in the top 10 most dangerous jobs in the United States. And I say that, Mac, bear with me, okay, because it plays into exactly what you've been talking about, the misperception on both sides. This whole argument about the thin blue line and blue lines matter is at times overstated. You and I have seen 18, 19-year-olds act with restraint when they're sitting there getting their bodies blown up every single day. Being a policeman, as dangerous though it may be in the United States, isn't anywhere near that level. The only reason I'm stating that is because there are misperceptions and misarguments on both sides in this. And you're right, we need to cut through it. Just as you said, the, you know, endemic racism in police departments is by statistics that you just laid out, appears to be exaggerated. And at the same time, this image of the police being under siege is also exaggerated. There is room, and there has to be room within their community. And great conversation the other day by Will Constantini about police unions and acceptance by the police unions that they owe their ability to police. They owe that to – it's always intended this way, the collaboration, cooperation of the local community in the same way that, you know, we do when we're conducting a counterinsurgency. Realization of that, and, you know, I understand the vast majority of cops understand that. But sadly, just that one video of you know, George Floyd, it's important not to extrapolate that to every police department in the country and assume all cops are like that.
Yeah,
but that one video says the world about the culture of Minneapolis Police Department. I'm not talking about the one thug kneeling on Floyd's neck. I'm talking about the other 3 dudes who are just standing there. You know, that to me, it's what the bystander does within that community that says everything about the culture. And I've looked at this within, you know, my own community or the special operations community. We've seen it in units that we've been in. It's not the act of a few bad apples. It is what the average Joe within that unit, how he responds to those bad apples, that tells you what you need to know about that unit's culture.
And it was interesting, my discussion with my daughter, because when she looks at that video, she sees racism, right?
Yeah.
And I said, that's not what I see. And she just looked at me. She said, are you crazy? I said, no. I mean, I've seen it, right? I know it. I said, I don't think you understand what it is to hate like that. And for people that have gone back to Iraq and Afghanistan repeatedly, right, I think you learn to hate, right? I mean, I interviewed somebody recently who's a minister now about fighting the North Vietnamese Army in the vicinity of Con Tien as a member of Alpha Company, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines. The entire interview, he referred to him as Gooks.
Yeah.
Ordained minister.
Yeah.
Right,
you depersonify the enemy, and the enemy does become hated.
And so that's, I mean, the way you make it make sense is you dehumanize them, right? They're assholes, they're slopes, they're all these other things, right?
Yeah.
And so,
but that's in a war, Mac.
And so
that's my point. The police are not at war. And so
well, but again, Andy, I mean, you say that, but do they feel that? And that guy's been doing that for 19 years. And in my opinion, he is so far around the fucking bend, right? And he must be the lead dog because nobody challenges him. Nobody fucks with him. Nobody grabs him by the shirt and yanks him off because the guy's already handcuffed.
Yeah.
And so, you know what I'm saying? So their mentality, we can say they're not at war. That's not how they feel.
Okay, well, let me give you a comparison.
Sure.
When I say they're not at war, I'm not blithely shooting from the hip. Statistically, you know, as I pointed out, the number of injured and dead, and don't get me wrong, before your listeners get all pissed at me, I'm just presenting another side of the coin.
No, and let me just tell you this.
I'm saying statistically,
Andy.
The numbers. Go ahead.
If we can't have a grown-up conversation about these issues, then what we'll be left with is the narrative that's out there and wherever the hell that takes us. And normally it doesn't take us to a good place. If you're not willing to confront the truth, then good luck to you.
Yeah. So let me give you a comparison. And you know this. It's a comparison that's familiar to you and most of your listeners. When we hear terms like war and we think about Anbar province during the bad times when the average infantry battalion was losing between 20 and 40 guys, 20 guys if they were lucky, and several hundred wounded in the course of a six-month deployment. And you remember how – and yes, there were anomalies. There were things like the Haditha massacre and bad things happened. But for the most part, you remember how the individual Marine acted with restraint in that kind of circumstance. And why did he do that? He did it because of leadership and accountability.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
Right.
And he was – you know, when I talk about the cops not being at war – I'm comparing it to Anbar province in Iraq, and I'll put that comparison against any cop who says his department's at war. You know, is that right, buddy? Are you seeing your friends blown away every single week? Every time you leave, you know, your police station, is there a danger that you're going to lose both your legs? Because that is what you and I and many of the listeners, that is our knowledge of war. And yet, we would never have condoned acts of brutality, right? We know how counterproductive they are. And why didn't they happen on a large scale? Because of leadership and because every single Marine understood that he would be held accountable. And that is how we helped. That is the only way in that sorry environment that we could prevent the culture from going upside down. And so, yes, I'm sounding uncompromising on this, but talk about the strategic corporal, you know, that cop who kneeled on Floyd's neck. I mean, he has caused protests around the globe, you know? And so it gets back to a lesson that we all understand, you know, those of us in uniform, that this just can't, you just can't, for all kinds of reasons, even if you don't care about humanity, even if you just don't give a shit about anyone not wearing, for instance, a blue uniform or a camouflage uniform, you still have to care about the culture within your organization because it'll come back on you.
Oh, my God. And let me tell you, and so there's a whole variety of reasons why you react to it. Let me read you an email that kind of goes down that road. I initially saw this as racism straight up. I've heard the conversation on your show, which I enjoy very much, over the course of the last week. I've since watched the videos again, and what I see has changed. First of all, watching him sit on that guy's neck, knowing that guy's handcuffed, and there's three other police officers there, still leaves me just shaking my head. The fact that the other three would not intervene, to me, is what I focus on now.
Yeah, great point.
What I see is one police officer's hatred of this guy who evidently he knew, and he means to kill him. And he calmly sits on his head and his neck, and he kills him in the most cold-blooded thing I've ever seen in my life that's been recorded. But the thing that really blows me away is that he does this while being filmed and heckled by civilians.
Yeah.
Now, most of us know when civilians show up, whether we were in Iraq or Afghanistan, and I assume the same would be true for a cop, your behavior, if it wasn't already in the box, certainly got there pretty quick. Even when you were really pissed, the presence of other civilians changed the way most people operated. On an American street, while you're being videotaped for him to murder that guy, what I see now is somebody who's completely engulfed in hate, who does not give a shit about anything because he knows better. I appreciate the discussion. Always makes me think, and for that I'm thankful. To Andy, just a quick note. Sorry for your loss. Your courage, no matter what Mac says about you being a marginal student, is commendable.
That's awesome, man. Who was that? you don't read out names? No, I tell you, I very much appreciate whoever that was. I think your comments were right on target, and that's not because of your kind words, but when you also commented about what shocked me, and that's the same thing that shocked me, was the other three dudes. You know, that's, again, that gets back to culture. That in itself, their inaction, and Fitz, you, I mean, Mac, I'm sorry, shit, I was thinking about Fitz whenever I think about
Mac
culture.
Don't call me Fitz, but, what the hell?
Whenever I think about sycophantic bystanders, I think about Fitz. But because he used to just stand by as you haze the students at IOC without taking action.
But I digress. That's baseless.
But I digress.
He didn't stand by, he was laughing.
Yeah, that's true. He was condoning it. But to that point, you made the point that, you know, he was kind of a big dog. And that's the way cultures go south, right?
Right.
You know, some of your listeners may have been on the drill field, and everyone knows that when a culture goes south within a platoon or within a series or within a company, it's because the senior drill instructors who dominate the culture within that environment have allowed or decided for it to do so, or are leading the charge. And that clearly was, you know, I know I'm jumping to conclusions, but I think it's a valid conclusion based on intuitive decision making or recognitional decision making. That is clearly what has happened in that police department, and that one video speaks volumes.
Well, I'll tell you the email's point about that guy's being videotaped and yelled at by civilians, and he doesn't change anything.
Nothing. What, you know, it's just incomprehensible, isn't it?
Right. No, it's like he's dead inside. He doesn't care.
Well, it gets to the point too about selection for police departments and what sort of testing, psychological testing they do. Of course.
Well, and Andy, let me – and I brought this up, and I'll be curious your thoughts on this. How long can you do that job in a major urban area? And I'm not talking about being Andy of Mayberry. I'm talking about in a major urban area where you respond to violent crime on a nightly basis, right? And every time you go on one of those calls, right, you're scared, you're nervous about it, I'm sure. And they're professional, but in the back of their mind, they know the deal, right? How long can you do that before you can't do it anymore, before you're so engulfed in hate, right? And I think that has to be part of this whole thing. 19 years of doing that?
Yeah.
I mean, how can you not?
That's a great point, you know, and that plays into leadership too, right?
Right.
So, you know, I mean, as trite though it may sound, if you're a leader within any organization, you know your people and you keep an eye on them and you transfer them and you move them around to avoid that sort of thing happening. So, again, that's, you know, and there's no way that this was an isolated incident.
Well, no, that guy's had, what, 18 or 19 complaints? But again, to Will Cosentini's point the other day, and Will had seen an article written by John Fund talking about police unions, and you know, he brought it up and he started discussing it, and that is, you can't look in his record because it's locked up, right?
Yeah.
And the police union, right, I think in a lot of communities, they have the board stacked in their favor. Right now, it's supposed to be like independently crafted, but if you read between the lines, they somehow or other make sure that they get the right people on that review board, and then they deep six all these complaints, and you can't go in, you don't have any right to look at the sealed complaint, and that's how they stand up for their union members. Well, to me, that's gone.
They're harming their own institution.
Exactly. Exactly, you know, but it's
a very short-sighted approach.
I do believe there ought to be.
You've seen that in the military, right?
Right. I do believe there ought to be some kind of look at how long can you do that as a Lance Corporal Patrolman before you can't do it anymore. And so then you either are going up in terms of leadership positions in the police force, you're becoming a detective, you're becoming a trainer, you're becoming, you know, an intel guy, but you can't stay on the street. You're not allowed to stay on the street in that same capacity because we know what's going to happen. And then for those of you that aren't going to get promoted, we have a GI Bill for you that pays for 4 years of college, a living stipend, you know, blah, 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 blah. And you go into some other line of work. But, yeah. But that's, you got to get smart people to look at the totality of the problem and say, okay, the police officers have this issue, right? And my initial thought was, well, like the Marine Corps, rotate them to a B billet and then back into the force. Well, there's not enough B billets in the police force, you know, relative to the guys on patrol. So to me, you got to limit it. And would that then bring, you know, what's worse, having, you know, a lot of novices on your police force or having older guys that are jaded and more prone to violence?
But that's the point again of leadership, is to define the guys that strike the right balance, so that you have positive, you have experience that is giving, you know, you have the benefits of people who are experienced, but only those who have shaped it positively and will do so to mentor those below them, and the guys who have, for whatever reasons, have become too jaded. You're right. There needs to be some way to either assign them elsewhere, when they're not coming into regular contact with the public, either as a temporary or permanent measure, or to ease them out of the police force with honor and with benefits. You know, unless they've already crossed the line, as to, you know, this particular guy has. But it, you know, and again, although it's cliched, it all comes back again. It's like so many things do to leadership. And having guys in who understand that and will enforce it, and I believe probably the vast majority of police departments are in good shape. I don't know. I have no, you know, way of telling. And I just, you know, I have probably like you, a lot of friends who are cops, and probably have issue with some of the things that I have said. You know, we argue about things like that, but you know, unfortunately. It just so happens that when things do go wrong, when the police department is struggling with culture, it can have exponential effects, as in this case, Minneapolis Police Department.
Has. I know. I mean, and which means they're no different than any other organization that, you know, is, you know, like the military, like the police. When show me bad units, I'll show you bad leaders. Yeah. And so, but I think, you know, to me, what I would wish the president would do is create a commission chaired by, you know, a black senator. My choice would be Tim Scott from South Carolina, and say, look, we're gonna take a hard look at this issue, and we're gonna make recommendations to police forces around the country about about the things that have to do to create more transparency to address. You know, the police perspective in this, which is mental health, which is, you know, longevity as a patrolman, and whether that's good for you. I mean, because when you look at the life of a police officer, a 10-year shorter life expectancy than the population, much higher, you know, divorce rate in urban centers of 70 to 80%. The national norm is 50. And then higher rates of alcoholism, higher rates of suicide. So when you look at that,
and no doubt about it, stressful job,
yeah. Right? And now we're going to throw that guy into that situation or girl and say, you're going to do that for that period of time, and you're going to be a lucid decision maker, you know, at critical times. It's like,
the individual himself is the last one, as we all know, to be able to judge what kind of condition he's in. You know, again, which gets back to the guys on either side of him and his immediate leadership, you know, the NCO level leadership, if you like.
Is there any other aspect, as we wind this down and I let you go, is there any other aspect of this, whether it be, you know, Pentagon leadership? To me, General Milley is another guy who's been caught in a compromise, as you said. He always strikes me as a no-nonsense, you know, human being, and he's a smart guy too. I think it'll be very interesting to watch how he navigates this as well, because I think what the president tries to do is he pushes people to be blindly loyal to him, and it doesn't, you know, and you know, we've seen people that we know have served. And I've got an email somebody wrote that said, you know, one of the things that was interesting about General Dunford's last year was that he seldom did press conferences. I believe he did that because he did not want to be asked specifically about the president pushing the DOD and the different things the president wanted, and that kept him from having to comment publicly on it.
That's a really good point. He perhaps did not want to be used as a political prop in the way that Esper and Milley found themselves being used. And that's a great point.
I don't disagree. I think it was General Dunford's way of staying clear of the president, offering his honest appraisals in private, and staying away from any kind of public criticism by not doing a whole lot of media stuff, which he didn't do his last year.
Hey, Mac, I'll leave you and your listeners with one last image, and it's a disturbing one. Okay, so 1982 was the battle for the Falklands, or the Malvinas, as the Argentinians mistakenly call the islands. And as you know, even with your moderate knowledge of military history, the Argentinians invaded in April of 1982 and then were subsequently evicted by British forces in June. Well, in Argentina at the time, there was a military junta headed by a guy named General Galtieri. And after the fall of the Falklands, there were riots that broke out all over Argentina, mostly in Buenos Aires, you know, because of the number of casualties and the fact that there was a perception that the war had been mismanaged. And there's news footage that I vividly remember on BBC of General Galtieri and a handful of his generals from this junta clearing away across the central square there in Buenos Aires, to the Metropolitan Cathedral to hold a press conference, you know, and his goons going ahead, firing tear gas and just battering protesters to make a way through there. And then these clowns just strutting away and posturing with the backdrop of tear gas and rioting in an effort to show that they were still in charge. And sadly, that is what I remembered and came to mind the other day when I saw that press conference there outside the St. John's Cathedral.
Yeah, no, it was not, it was nobody's finest moment, to be honest with you.
No.
I'll tell you what, the other thing is, setting that thing on fire, I mean, like, what in God's name, man? What in God's name? All right, man. Andy, first of all, I always appreciate the conversation with you. And, again, want to thank you for not only coming on today, but your candor and your courage coming on talking about Susan, one of your older sisters, yesterday. And God bless you. And we'll keep Susan and your whole family in our prayers. And, as always, an honor and a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for doing this.
Hey, thanks very much, Mac, and thank you to all your listeners. All the best to you.
All right, bud. See you. Andy Milburn here on a Wednesday. Sorry about that. That was a little loud. Yeah, I have a problem with my sound card. Sometimes things get updated, and then for whatever reason, the Skype program takes over my sound card, and it turns down another sound card that this is associated with. So when Skype is activated, my other primary sound card is diminished substantially, so it has to be turned up. So then what happens is I have to turn it up. And then when I turn it on without turning it down, that's how you get what you just got. Sorry about that. So anyhow, if you're just tuning in hour one, you'll hear me talking about yesterday's interview with Andy about the suicide of two older sisters, Susan. You should listen to that. Bernard Kurak was on Tucker Carlson's show and for the first time talked about the numbers of black men that have been killed in this country in 2019. First time I've seen that data point. So that was interesting. So talk about that. Talking about the playbook that's out there. So major protest, Antifa types, right, create anarchy by creating opportunities to loot. And in that way, they create anarchy in the city. Underneath that, criminal enterprises then execute the looting in other parts of the city. So you'll hear me talk about that. And, you know, what I believe the response ought to be of any state or city in terms of how do you prevent that next time? Because the next time you have a major protest, you're going to see the same shit. And then in hour two, if you just catch it. And then the other topic of hour one is the SecDef, Mark Esper, who's a B-team guy, hired specifically because he's not going to challenge the president too much. And has been that guy. And all of a sudden, this morning, comes out and says that he doesn't support the use of the Insurrection Act. And had no intention of being part of the photo op at St. John's. So, when do we get a new SecDef? So, we talk about that too. But Mark Esper stepped up in a way that I didn't expect him to. Right? Because he's a B-team guy. So, anyway. In the first day of the fifth year. Interesting conversation today. Thank you to everybody. Again. And on the first day of the fifth year, you know, again, going out the door, I just want to acknowledge, you know, people that have made All Marine Radio what it is. And, you know, were it not for Bob Nielsen, wouldn't exist. I would have had to gone to a work to support myself, and All Marine Radio would have become maybe a once a week or a twice a week event and not what it is. Also, the other person that's been, you know, that opened the door, that changed, that gave me an opportunity to share what I've learned in doing this program for 4 years is General Furness. And the opportunity to do post-traumatic winning with the 2nd Marine Division, which then opened doors for me to do it throughout the Marine Corps, which then opened doors for me to do it with the Air Force, with first responders, and it's impacted a huge number of lives. There's no doubt in my mind that it's kept people from killing themselves. It's changed the lives of people, and then it empowers them to go change the lives of other people. So as I often say, good on top of good on top of good on top of good. So hopefully that all continues. So on a Wednesday, stay tuned. I got to switch computers to execute hour one, but I'll do that. So don't touch that dial, because I got to reboot this computer so the settings go back to what they should be. Make sense? Okay, even if it doesn't. Stand by. No, not for that. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.